Today's official topic is supposed to be delocalization, but we've actually talked a little bit about the delocalization already. So what I'm going to do is switch instead to finishing off the equilibrium discussion that we didn't have time to finish the other day, because there were two very important things that we didn't get to cover. One of them was Le Chatelier's principle, and associated with this, with Le Chatelier's principle, is this idea of Q versus K. So even before we do that, though, I want to talk about the process of a system attaining equilibrium, because if we're going to talk about disturbing equilibrium, we first got to talk about attaining it. Instead of talking about a chemical reaction as my example, I want to take something that's a little easier to draw out, which is about vapor pressure. So could someone tell me what vapor pressure is? But don't everybody answer at once. Oh my, what is vapor pressure? Yes?
If you place liquid in a closed container, the gas phase created because of that liquid exerts pressure to the wall of that container, which is technically vapor pressure.
And it only builds up to a certain maximum value at any particular temperature, right? Why is it that a liquid would produce a gas if it was not at its boiling point? Because some of the molecules have enough energy. So remember that energy distribution diagram that you saw last week that I'll just very quickly draw a rough version up again. So we have energy per molecule, and we have number of molecules. So the idea is that some fraction of molecules has enough energy to be able to evaporate. The reverse is going to be true as well, though, that at any particular temperature, if you have a gas phase, the ones that are moving too slowly would condense again. And then again, depending on your temperature, depending on the energy distribution, some fraction of molecules would also always therefore condense. So you have this back and forth that goes on if you take a liquid and put it into a container. And in fact, we could discuss this as four different stages. So in this discussion, the forward process is going to be evaporation, making the vapor. The reverse process is going to be condensation. Now, if, let's say at the instant of time zero, you have a container that's under vacuum that you suddenly introduce liquid into. If we're talking about terms reactants and products, we only have reactants. There are no products.
Is it
T? T. Time? T equals zero.
Is it time?
Time, yes. So if there's only products, that means the rate of the reverse reaction is zero. You only have the forward process. So there's vapor that's forming, liquid that's evaporating, again, because a fraction of molecules have enough energy to be able to evaporate. So just after that starting point, you have formed some vapor. At any particular temperature, there's going to be some quantity of that vapor that then condenses. But if you've just started the process of allowing the liquid to generate its vapor pressure, there's not going to be a heck of a lot of that product yet. So here, the rate of the forward process is still greater than the rate of the reverse process. So some vapor is now condensing. But it's the liquid is still evaporating at a rate greater than the condensation of that vapor. At some point, when you reach equilibrium, you'll have enough vapor around that the rate of the condensation of that vapor matches the rate of evaporation. And at that point, you'll have no more change in pressure, because every little bit that's evaporating is condensing at an equal rate. That is the point at which vapor pressure is measured, because vapor pressure is an equilibrium phenomenon. But now let's imagine one more case. Let's say that let's see, how should I express this? Let's say that we somehow inject extra vapor into the system. And don't worry physically how this is being accomplished. Just let's say all of a sudden vapor appears. Well, if we were already at equilibrium, but we now have too much vapor around, that means the rate of condensation is actually going to be greater than the rate of evaporation. We're going to be past equilibrium. The concentration of products will be too great. The rate of the reverse reaction will now be greater than the rate of forward reaction. And overall, condensation occurs. So let me walk through this four-step process again. If you only have liquid, you have no reverse reaction. So the only thing that can happen is the liquid's evaporating. As the liquid keeps evaporating, though, you're going to build up vapor, and that vapor, some of it's going to condense. At first, the rate of evaporation will still be greater than condensation until you reach a point where the two are in balance with each other. But then if you subtly mess with the equilibrium by putting in more vapor, which in this case is a product, well, that means that suddenly the rate of the reverse process has increased, but the rate of the forward process hasn't. And so as a result, the equilibrium will shift. Now that I've given you this physical example, let's now talk about Le Chatelier's principle. Which is that when a system at equilibrium is stressed, which means changed, the system will respond in a way that relieves that stress. And when discussing Le Chatelier's principle, if we're dealing with concentrations, because let me step back for a moment, if we change temperature, we're going to cause a shift in an equilibrium as well, because temperature affects both the rate of the forward and reverse reactions. So if we ignore temperature changes, though, we're going to be mainly looking at concentration. So we're trying to figure out how changing concentration might affect equilibrium. That's what Q is. Q is called the reaction quotient. And Q is mathematically identical to K. Except K is only calculated at equilibrium concentrations. While Q can be calculated at any point in a reaction. And let's see a graphical example of that then. What kind of diagram did I just draw? Reaction progress diagram. How is it different from a reaction coordinate diagram? So we're looking at a solution, a whole bunch of molecules as they go from reactants to products. A reaction coordinate diagram is just looking at one set of molecules. So they display two different things. Yes?
Is it also linear in terms of time?
No. No assumption about time is made here. Because in terms of time, you'll never actually get to products. You'll get to equilibrium, but not 100% products. Equilibrium is the lowest energy point on this curve. Q is wherever you happen to be during a chemical reaction. So let's say that I put Q right at this point. Not worrying about specific reaction, in general, we could say that Q is a measure of products over reactants. And in this situation, if Q is less than K, then not enough products have formed. Or another way to express it is there are too many reactants around. Another possibility is if Q is greater than K. Then not enough reactants are present. Or you could say too many products have formed. Now, aside from reviewing for equilibrium just for equilibrium's sake, why are we covering this? Because I'm going to use this explanation to explain what happens when we have a strong base that neutralizes a weak acid. Because a weak acid is something that doesn't like to dissociate. And what we're going to talk about is if we force it to dissociate, we force it to get out of its equilibrium. What does that mean it's going to do in response? And in fact, let's take an example, something that you have not learned at all yet this quarter, something you won't, in fact, get until next quarter, I believe. And so this mechanism I'm about to write, do not panic at all about having to memorize it. It's just being used as an example for the moment. We will learn at some point that when there's water around, a ketone can undergo a reversible reaction with that water. Where, much like one of the steps you've seen this quarter already, a oxygen can become protonated, which then can cause some other event to occur. In this case, if we want to carefully show what's going on, I can write a resonance structure. And it's actually because of resonance structures that we need to have a brief discussion on delocalization today. But when that positive charge is now moved, water can come and attack. Which, like so many times we've already seen even, because water started off neutral, the oxygen on the product will initially be positively charged. A proton comes off, and we end up with a neutral OH group. This is a geminal diol. But because this was made by adding water to it, sometimes it's just referred to as a hydrate. Now, what if I tell you that this reaction is actually not that favorable? That this doesn't like to move forward very much at all? Can you think of a way that I could force this reaction to happen? What's that? I've heard make it acid, make it basic, and remove product. You already have acid there, and acid actually is just a catalyst because it comes on at the beginning, but it also hops off during the middle of the process. So it might help in terms of that initial formation, that rate, but it might not end up adjusting, might not, the balance of equilibrium. If we add base, we'd remove the H+, and the reaction wouldn't happen at all. But if we remove products, what does that mean? If suddenly we removed products, well, we could think about that as in a few ways. If we're removing products, we're effectively going back uphill energetically towards reactants. And so the reaction would want to go back downhill again, make more products to get to that lowest energy point. Another way of thinking about it is at equilibrium, you've got equal rates of the forward and reverse reactions. If you suddenly remove products, then the forward reaction is going to be greater all of a sudden. Because by removing those products, you've reduced the rate of the reverse reaction. And so because of that, the reaction is going to move forward. If all you remember from equilibrium is that, oh, if Q is less than K, it's going to go forward. Well, if we suddenly remove products, Q has the form of products over reactants. Q will be less than K. And so the reaction will again proceed forward to make more products. No matter which way I explained it, when you remove products, the reaction tries to form more products. If you continually remove it, then you're going to force the reaction to completion. And that's an application of Le Chatelier's principle. Le Chatelier's principle, again, is that you stress a system, it responds to the stress. If you remove products, more products form. If you add reactants, reactants are used up. If you pull out reactants, reactants form. Because remember, this is reversible. So whatever you do, it does the opposite. But let me write down this example because we'll do exactly this technique later on the quarter. We're going to remove a product as it forms to force a reaction to go to completion. So this particular reaction is reversible and non-spontaneous. I haven't used this term yet, but what does non-spontaneous mean? Positive change in free energy. That's right. The delta G is going to end up being greater than zero, which means if I wanted to write a reaction progress diagram for this, it would probably look more closely to something like this. And the equilibrium is going to lie close to the reactant side, therefore. If products are suddenly removed when the reaction
is at equilibrium. So if we've removed reactants, that means Q is going to be less than K. Since Q is an expression of products over reactants, and the concentration of products just decreased. Another way you could say it is the rate of the reverse reaction is now greater, rate of the forward reaction is greater than the rate of the reverse reaction, since products have been removed. But not reactants. And then, three, the potential energy of the system is effectively increased. Therefore, the reaction will move forward to make more products, to reestablish equilibrium. And so to complete this example, the practical upshot of this, again, is that if products are continuously removed as they form, the reaction can be forced to completion, even though it is non-spontaneous. Now, we could tell exactly the same story in a few other situations. For example, sometimes to push a reaction forward, it's actually easier just to add a ton of reactants. And so you'll see a reaction next quarter, somewhat similar mechanism. But in real life, instead of removing products, we just flood it with the solvent, which happens to be one of the reactants. If you push a whole bunch of reactants into the system, then that makes Q, again, less than K, which will push the reaction forward. Yes? Completion means 100% products. Gone. Right. So at equilibrium, you'll never have 100% products if you truly have equilibrium. Because, if you have 100% reactants or 100% products, the one of the reactions or the other you don't have, so it's not imbalance, so it's not at equilibrium. Yes?
So in that example, if you just put tons of water, the product will...
It may try to form. But then you end up with a real-life problem where what if the material is not fully soluble in water? This one, 2-pentanone might... be a little bit. Acetone is water soluble. I don't know if pentanone is. So sometimes, even if conceptually it might work, physically you might not be able to do it. Yes?
Is principle applied to every reaction?
Any reversible reaction, yes. Now, some reactions, there may be other tricks you can play. For example, in gas reactions, sometimes if you have one gas making another, then if you have a gas reaction that takes one molecule and splits it into two, then temperature can cause the reaction to shift one way or another because it's trying to relieve pressure. And in fact, that leads me to one last statement I needed to make about equilibrium, is that K is only affected by temperature, not concentration. So big K, the equilibrium constant, equilibrium itself can shift backwards and forwards. The position of where a reaction is can shift around. But the ratio of reactants and products itself is a constant. So if you change in concentration, reaction may move one way or another until you get back to exactly the same proper ratios. So K never changes because you change the concentration of something. And so in this example, if I remove products, I changed concentration. So the reaction shifted to get back to K. So the change in concentration didn't change K, it just made the reaction have to do some work. The only thing that can change K is by changing temperature, because that changes the rate of both the forward and reverse reactions. Yes? Not if you remove it and don't allow it to react under the conditions that would let it reverse. So that's part of the idea, that you would keep it free from acid so that the reverse reaction would not be possible. If you removed it, but then it was in the same reaction environment, then yes, it would try to react backwards and reestablish equilibrium.
So you mean after the product form, you just
remove it and try to keep it isolated. In real life, in this particular example, it's tough to isolate hydrates because you get a little acid around and they will go backwards. But those details we'll worry about next quarter when we actually have this functional group. Questions about equilibrium? So we managed to finish equilibrium. We actually managed to mostly finish kinetics as well. The only thing from thermodynamics we need to wrap up with, which we'll do that tomorrow with acids and bases, is this idea of what does something stable mean. Now, giving you a little forward notice, the lecture this Friday will not be on the exam. The exam is next week on Monday.
Break.
What? Your last exam was 2 weeks ago now, wasn't it?
You never give us weekends.
I know.
What do you mean? You have the weekends to study.
Yeah,
no, no, no. Think about it this way. Do you want your exams on Friday so then you then have your weekends free, or do you want the weekend to be able to study?
Study.
Which is why I scheduled all the exams on Mondays, so you do have the weekends to be able to study. Like, would you all would have rather had your lab quiz on Friday, this past Friday?
No,
I didn't think so. Most of you, as a class. Because you don't have class Tuesday. No, 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 it will be on Monday. The reason I'm telling you this, though, is to warn you that Friday's your last chance to ask questions. And actually, Friday's lecture in itself is going to be a little shorter so that we have time for you to ask questions. And I'll try to do a summary in class, Wednesday, so you know what to study to come up with questions for. But let's go ahead and move then to delocalization. And I'll start with the same example that we had the other day. And I'll go ahead and write out the smog diagram one more time for this. We had discussed previously how each carbon in this molecule is sp2 hybridized. And the discussion point that came up, therefore, is, well, what do we do about the p orbitals that the way we think of hybridization would exist? Because the question could be, well, do we connect the two p orbitals on the left, or do we connect the two p orbitals on the right? And the answer being end up being yes. In other words, that we connected all those p orbitals. So the focus for delocalization today is not going to be so much on writing the Smong diagram, and that's the foundation of what we're going to talk about. But I want to talk about proper writing of resonance structures. That's really the big deal. Resonance structures only exist because the system used to write structures Lewis dot structures. That's really the line structures are just a modified form of Lewis dot structures. So the system used to write these is unable to unambiguously represent bonds that cover more than two atoms. So a line, when we draw it, that means a bond between two things. If we have three things that are overlapping, how do we write one bond that covers those three? If we had six things overlapping, like benzene, then how would we write benzene? Well, there are dotted lines that are sometimes used, but that's a really poor way to do things if we're trying to count electrons. Part of the reason that Lewis dot structures can be useful, even in these situations, is that one line means two electrons. So in these two resonance structures that I drew for the allocation, at least we can count how many total electrons are involved. But you have to know that those are resonance structures. So no single resonance structure correctly reflects the true structure of a molecule. The true structure of a molecule can be estimated, you could say, by averaging all possible resonance structures together. And so we could come up with some rules for writing resonance structures. Which there's one main one and then some other considerations. The main rule is that only lone pairs and pi bonds are able to move. Single bonds can never be formed or broken. Why is that true? Well, let me draw a different example molecule, and we'll see the case involved here. Let's say I had the allyl anion instead of the allyl cation. It turns out it has a pair of resonance structures as well. Mechanistically, I could write that resonance by showing the lone pair attacking the double bond and pushing the electrons over. If we were to draw a Smong diagram, we'd need to know the hybridization of each of these atoms. So let's take the second molecule I drew where the negative charge is on the left-hand side. What is the hybridization of that carbon? If you said sp3, then you weren't looking at the true molecular structure. Remember that resonance structures individually do not reflect the correct structure. That pair of electrons does not exist in an sp3 orbital. That carbon is sp2 hybridized. And you think, no, it's not. It's all single bonds. Well, what about the resonance structure on the left? It's the same molecule, isn't it? Because resonance structures are just different pictures of the same molecule. But this same molecule, it is sp2. So how could it go from sp2 to sp3 if it's really the same molecule? And the answer is it doesn't. It's just that the way we write structures fails to properly show what the hybridization should be. Let me make this a big point. This carbon is actually sp2 hybridized. It appears sp3 in this structure. That is because resonance structures fail to show delocalized bonding. Now, I can't remember if I defined this term delocalized or not, but think of local, and then delocalized means it's not local. It's somewhere besides just right in one location. So delocalized gets this idea across that the electrons are flowing across multiple atoms. What would the smog diagram for this look like? Identical to the allyl cation. It's just that there's now two more electrons floating around that pi system. Well, why is it that you could have one case where you have a positive charge, and then this molecule, it's still fine to put two more electrons into? Well, if we had two p orbitals and only two p orbitals interacting, which underneath that really means there's just two atoms interacting, how many molecular orbitals did we say exist in a case where two p orbitals overlap? In other words, if I just had a plain old carbon-carbon double bond, what kind of orbital is the double bond? What kind of bond is it? So you got a sigma bond that's there, but you also have a pi bond. If you have a pi bond, what else is there but empty? The antibond, right? So in the case of pi bonding, you always have one lower energy level and one upper energy level. And how did that occur? Because you either had zero nodes between the two atoms, or you had one node between the two atoms. How come you didn't have more than that? Because you only had two atoms, it turns out. In a pi system, the number of atoms tells you the maximum number of nodes. But wait a minute. If I now have three atoms, what does that mean that my three molecular orbitals are going to look like? Well, one energy level will look like this. No nodes. One energy level will look like this. Two nodes. Then the last one will have three. The maximum number of nodes in a pi system is equal to the number of atoms minus one. So, three atoms, three p orbitals, one, zero, one, and two nodes. And these are what the molecular orbitals for this pi system are going to look like, because these pi orbitals or p orbitals are lined up in kind of a line. And so imagine that phone cord example that I keep referring back to. The two ends would be like the ends of the phone cord. And in fact, as we make more complicated orbital systems, the more orbitals we add in, the more nodes that are possible, but the lowest energy version is always one orbital where the sign is equal across the molecule. Of course, these are just idealized representations. What we need to do is use p orbitals to estimate what these molecular orbitals are going to look like. Because that's exactly what we did with pi bonds and antibonds. Pi bonds and antibonds exist. We use p orbitals to describe them. And the way we did it is for the bond, we added two orbitals that had the same sign as each other. And for the antibond, we added opposites. Same type of thing is going to happen in this case. If I wanted an orbital in which there was only one sign across the whole thing, then what way would I shade my p orbitals to achieve that? I'd just shade them in all the same way, wouldn't I? That would be the lowest energy configuration you could have. No nodes. What about the highest energy configuration? Well, what if you had a node between each atom? Then that could be represented by the p orbital flipping signs each time. And that's why the maximum number of nodes in a linear system is the number of atoms minus one. But what about this middle case, where the node effectively would pass through the middle of this p orbital? Then we wouldn't even use that p orbital to estimate what the molecule looks like. We'd have one orbital on one side, one orbital on the other, and so the molecular orbital picture would look like this. And you might say, wait, how could that p orbital disappear? P orbital's not there. Remember, this is just our model to estimate what one of these systems looks like. But the p orbitals don't exist. So we could do whatever we want on paper. And in the proper approach, we would just say the coefficient for that orbital ends up being zero. So now let me ask you in terms of energy. This bottom orbital, do you think this is bonding? Mm-hmm. Why?
No nodes.
But why does that mean there's bonding? Well, why was a pi bond a bond? What was so good about it that it made it a bond?
Electron density.
Well, goes where?
Between
the nuclei, right? The idea is you're putting electrons between the nuclei. If these overlap with the same sign, then you're going to end up with a smear across the molecule. The electrons are spread out. That's putting electrons between positive charges. That's favorable. So this is a bonding orbital. Now the top one, where every other atom, the sign of that orbital changes. What's that going to mean as far as electrons between the nuclei? There aren't any. The node's there. So if there's no electron between the nuclei, then they're exposed, and that's unfavorable. Unlike the pi star before that we had, this has got two types of unfavorable interactions. So really not likely. So this would be an antibonding orbital. But what about the middle case? There's no interaction, really. That's right. These orbitals are so far away, they effectively don't interact, and so it is a non-bonding orbital. In terms of relative energy, that non-bonding orbital would have an energy of zero.
What is zero?
Zero is the energy of unreacted atoms. So in other words, when you bring the system together, if you had electrons in this non-bonding orbital, they're not higher or lower in energy, and so they don't really help or hurt the system. So in the allyl cation, we only had two electrons. We had a pi bond next to a positive charge. The pi bond only had two electrons in it. This system, because it has four electrons, you'd occupy the bonding orbital, and in this case, you'd also occupy the non-bonding orbital. But because the non-bonding orbital doesn't hurt or help, doesn't matter if the electrons go there. But this also explains why the electrons can delocalize. So we had our one rule for writing resonance structures, which is that lone pairs and pi bonds can move around. This is one example of why. More generally, you just need to know that lone pairs and pi bonds are the only ones that do move. There is a secondary rule that you could say would help you choose between good and bad resonance structures. So better resonance structures generally have full octets where possible. Lack of charge separation. And charges that, how to say this simply, that match electronegativity. And what I mean by that is the following. We could take something like acetone. And because it only involves the pi bond, I could show the bond magically opening up. But this would technically just be a resonance structure. And the second structure I wrote is unfavorable due to charge separation. I could have another example where I'd even did it the other direction. I could open that pi bond up towards the carbon. If I did that, I end up with a positive on the oxygen, a negative on the carbon. Well, oxygen certainly doesn't like being positive, so that's an even worse structure than what I wrote above. And then as far as octets, I'd have to think of a really contrived example to show you a case where we'd be comparing octet structures. That happens more in Chem 1A. But the reason I'm showing you this delocalization, the molecular orbital energies, we might not come back to this quarter, but we get it heavily next quarter. The main point is that when we're writing mechanisms, you need to know that both of these molecules really represent just one structure. And that will come back when we talk about how to write mechanisms properly. So we're out of time. Now, for everyone, the morning section did the TLC stain, and they got it to work. Many people did get color changes. Because of that, I do want you to incorporate those color changes into your lab report.
Now, I made a big goof over the weekend, and I apologize. The extra work, well, not extra work, but the work done before you really had to have it done. Because since you still need to incorporate these color changes into your lab reports, they shouldn't really be due today because you hadn't done the TLC stains yet. So, I made the lab report due Thursday for the other section, but I also don't have all of your lab reports graded yet, so I'm just going to make for all the sections the lab report now due Friday. Just give everybody the same amount of time. That way I can get your lab reports back tomorrow, and so you can have those comments to patch up your lab reports for Friday. Section 2, you will get your lecture quizzes number 2 back in lab today, and we'll go over the answers in lab today.